Man, these people took my kids from me, then they froze my bank account. I got so much anger in me, got no way to take it out. Think I'm stuck in a matrix, when I fuzz my nitrous. Yes, I am a cuck, I like when people fuck on my bitch. The shit that I post on Twitter, they telling me, hey, don't say that. How niggas can't see me in public, I'm driving an all-chrome Maybach. With all of the money and fame, I still can't get my kids back. With all of the money and fame, I still don't get to see my children. Niggas see my Twitter, but they don't see how I be feeling. So I became a Nazi, yeah, bitch, I'm the villain.
Nigga, how healer? Nigga, how healer? They don't understand the things I say on Twitter. Nigga, how healer?
Yesterday, I'd like, just as a cultural artifact, let's just concentrate on one day. What happened in one day? Kanye released his video, Nigger Heil Hitler, and the Catholic Church chose another pope. This is, we're talking about, I've talked about this before, but at the end of the Republic, everything is falling apart and things are speeding up. So to begin with, let's talk about Kanye West's video. What does this mean? Nigger Heil Hitler. Okay, we're talking about two of the fundamental myths of the Third Republic. We're talking about the Third Republic beginning with the victory over Hitler in World War II, leading to the creation of the Holocaust narrative, which is basically the foundational myth of the Third Republic, which is basically Americans are good people who rescue other people from tyranny, specifically racial tyranny. Remember Anthony Blinken, he had his own version of this when his stepfather steps out of the woods, sees a tank. Okay, it's the end of the war. It's an American tank. The hatch opens up and there's a black man. And he says he lifted my father up into the tank, into America, and into freedom. That's the myth. It never happened. Blinken made it up completely. We all know that by now. There is no black tank battalion anywhere near where his father-in-law or stepfather was. But that's the story. And what we have here is Kanye West mounting a kind of frontal assault on the founding myths, the sacred cows of the Third Republic. The Holocaust, which I've already mentioned, leading to Brown versus School Board, the Supreme Court decision saying that segregation was illegal, the creation of the civil rights movement, and the decision on the part of the United States of America that no one would ever say nigger again. Well, those days are over, nigga. Get with the plan, okay? And on the same day that we're talking about here, the video comes out. We have a young lady, a mother by the name of Shiloh Hendricks, who makes $500,000 on GoFundMe because she said the word nigger. She called some five-year-olds on the playground a nigger. And there is so much. Again, here's another category, nigger fatigue. It's a category on X. There's so much of it out there. People are so sick of this that they gave her $500,000. Now, if we go back to the video, Kanye's upset about Harley Pasternak. He's still talking about it. That was his so-called trainer, who in real life was a drug dealer and a controller. He was a celebrity controller, and he was threatening to, gets into it in the story, put him in a mental institution or something like that, or drug him up and make sure he'd never see his children again. And Kanye's upset. And so in order to express being upset, he goes to the opposite, which is Hitler. And he identifies with Hitler and identifies with the Nazis because Hitler and the Nazis didn't like Jews. This is pretty simplistic. It's pretty simplistic. And it's, what should I say? Mistaken. It's a kind of simplistic, stupid reaction to something where he lost focus. He lost focus immediately after that incident happened when he went public with the Harley Pasternak thing. He then went on Alex Jones and put a stocking over his head and talked about Hitler. There was rejoicing at ADL headquarters. I could hear the champagne corks popping in South Bend, Indiana when Kanye did that, because that's precisely what they wanted him to do. What am I talking about here? This is a substantiation of the very thing that he's trying to object to. In other words, the racial narrative. Okay? It takes two groups to create the racial narrative. One is white and the other is black. And the point of this, the Jewish creation of this race war, was to divide and conquer, to weaken the majority. It became a full-fledged revolution in the South. It became something like that in the North, the disruption of ethnic neighborhoods in Chicago when Martin Luther King shows up. I'm a product of this. We moved from an Irish neighborhood into a suburb and became white after the blacks moved into that neighborhood in North Philadelphia. It's a story I've told in the Slaughter of Cities. It's a story I've told. We're familiar with that, this story. This is the, if you, I understand why you're upset if you're a young person and you had to check off a box that said white every time you applied for a job or wanted to get into graduate school, because it meant that you were automatically disadvantaged. That was unjust. I'm not denying that. Why do say people can continue to say that I'm denying this? I get these letters from this lady called Sarah Stock. Kill yourself. What'd she say? Kill yourself, anti-white faggot. Anti-white faggot, she called me. How many children do you have, Sarah? I have five. I have 23 grandchildren. I don't know why you're calling me a faggot, but I guess that's the limit of your vocabulary. I don't know. But this is the type of reaction. So immediately, these guys all say, I'm against that. So we run, and they substantiate the narrative by giving this white lady whose only achievement in life is calling some five-year-old a nigger, give her $500,000. There is rejoicing in oligarch headquarters when this happens because it substantiates the racial narrative. And the racial narrative is there to divide and conquer. Ever since the beginning of the racial narrative in Virginia, after the Bacon's Rebellion, when the African slaves and the Celtic slaves united against the oligarchs and almost overthrew the government. We have to divide them between white, that's when the term came into being, and black. They're both the same. They're both social constructs. I'm not saying black is not a social construct. They're both social constructs whose purpose is political control. So, oh, what else happened? Oh, we elected a new pope. How does the new pope fit into this scheme? Is he white? This is like asking, is Beethoven's Fifth Symphony green or orange? These categories do not apply here. We're talking about a completely different situation. So it turns out that technically, his mother is Creole. Creole, you can look it up, is a mixture particular to Louisiana of all of those races that came to places like New Orleans, which was a significant port. It's at the mouth of the Mississippi. Lots of, you know, people from all over, but it's primarily French, Spanish, Italian, Negro, and Indian. You mix them all together and you got a Creole. Are they white? No. No. This is this guy's background. Why are they all mixing there like that? Well, because it was Catholic. And Catholic race is not a Catholic category. I don't know how many times I have to say this. Race cannot be a category for the universal church, because race is always saying there's one race that is better than the other and is better than every other race. This flows naturally from the development of Protestant churches. They are state churches. There are two in particular. One was England. That was an island. That is an island of one particular group of people. They were mixed too. I mean, there were French and there were Vikings and there were Celts, and they were all mixed together and they were all different races, but they all looked pretty much the same. And everybody got used to feeling that the church was one particular group of people. That's not true. That's Protestantism. The same thing happened in Germany. It's a little bit different because there was no Germany as a country at the time of the Reformation. There were innumerable principalities, lots of principalities, and some of them went over to the Protestant church, and some of them went over to the Lutheran church, and some of them stayed Catholic. And they fought a war called the 30 Years' War, and it was incredibly destructive, and they finally came up with a solution at the Peace of Westphalia, and it was called Cuius Reus Eius Religio, and basically the prince determined the religion, which means once again you had a state church, and once again a state church is only one group of people. Now, the difference with Germany is it had no colonies. They didn't colonize Africa. There were technically were colonies in Africa, but they didn't amount to much of anything. And so, therefore, it was pretty much just one group of people. And as time went on, you apply this corrosive thing called, which we will call secularism. And basically, the religious devotion, the religious spirit evaporated from these Protestant sects to the point of now where they're going out of existence. And what was left? The racial identity. So the state church led inexorably to the racial regime. In Germany, it was even clearer because the state church led to the Lutheran Church accepted Hitler's race laws in 1933. I had a guy on, a crazy guy, calls himself a Lutheran. I think he's been expelled from the church, but correct me if I'm wrong. His name was Mahler, and he basically followed through, and he said, yeah, that's true. He was honest, and I think he was accurate in saying how the state church leads inexorably to racism, and he followed it through, and he says, yeah, I'm a racist, and I believe that the Lutheran church should be racist. The Lutheran church doesn't agree with them, but I'm not changing the point. This did not happen in the Catholic Church. What happened in areas controlled by Catholics? Well, you ended up with Creoles. You know, the French and the Spanish and the Africans and the Indians and the Italians all intermarried, and they come up with their own particular group, and that is the mother of the Pope. So he's the product, like me, a product of race mixing. So how is this going to identify Pope Leo XIV? How is this going to be the key to understanding Pope Leo XIV? It isn't. It doesn't explain anything. It doesn't explain anything. So let's go down. Maybe we'll try some other things. He went to Villanova. 8 years. He's 8 years younger than me. He went to Villanova, which is right near St. Joseph's University. which is where I went. And these are Catholic universities in Philadelphia. Did that make an impression on him? Well, apparently it did, because it's run by the Augustinians, and now he's an Augustinian priest. Okay, and now he's the Pope. Okay, but what's that got to do with being white? I don't think he's white. His father was from Chicago, so there's French blood there. There's all of that Creole mixture there. At that point, it seems pretty clear to me that his identity is Catholic. And if you want to understand what he is and what he's going to do, try thinking of him as a Catholic, which has no relevance whatsoever to the race issue. It doesn't exist. It cannot exist in the Catholic Church. So at this point, he becomes a priest and he becomes a missionary in Peru. And so he goes there, and he apparently likes it there, spends a lot of time there riding around on his horse long enough so that he can learn Spanish, speak it fluently. What have I been saying for months, if not years? It's language that is the key to ethnic identity, okay? And when you move from country to country, you have to learn the language if you want to fit in. If you learn the language, you will be accepted. Well, that's exactly what happened to him. He's called an American, but he was so accepted in Peru that he became a Peruvian citizen. So what's the overlay here? You put all these overlays, the only identity that I can see is Catholic. That's his identity. That's the identity. And what we're seeing here is the Catholic identity. Now, I'm talking that now from a global point of view. It's changing, I think. There was a time when if you wanted to be a Catholic, you had to be a Jew. And that caused a lot of controversy between St. Paul and St. Peter, because St. Paul started preaching to the Gentiles. They all spoke Greek. He had a dream, and somebody beckoned him to come over to Greece. And the first crisis in the Catholic Church was, do you have to be a Jew to become a follower of Jesus Christ? Do you have to be circumcised? Do you have to follow the dietary laws? Well, Peter kind of felt that you did, and Paul abused him or corrected him to his face, rebuked him to his face, and said, no, this cannot be the Catholic Church, because it's not the Hebrew people anymore. They are not God's chosen people. They can join, be saved if they do just what everyone else does, which is to be baptized. So, okay, that's the end of the Jewish church. And then we have the Roman church, and that lasted a long time and forever. The church is constantly identifying with a group of people, then suddenly has to move on, because there are more groups of people that are coming in all the time, and no one group, like Italians, over 200 popes have been Italians. So obviously they played a crucial role in this whole thing. But it went beyond Italy, went beyond the Roman Empire, it went beyond the European Empire, it went to the New World, because it's the universal church, and this is what its destiny is. And so I'm saying, if you want to understand what's going on, that's what has to happen. Had a discussion with a good friend of mine. And we, as I've already mentioned, were closely associated with the papacy of Pope Francis at the beginning, because we knew a guy in the State Department. And this part of the discussion that was taking place then was basically John Paul II collaborating with the American Empire to bring down communism, which he succeeded in doing. And then is thinking, maybe we should collaborate with the Americans and come up with a new kind of magisterial approach, a new evangelism that will be based on the Ten Commandments, but in universal values. Maybe we could collaborate with the American Empire. Well, it found out you can't. You could not, and you can't, because the American Empire was run by libido dominandi, and the people who were successful in overthrowing communism lied to Gorbachev, James Baker lied to Gorbachev when he said they weren't going to expand it eastward, expand NATO eastward. And they did it anyway. And they destroyed one of the great moments, one of the great possibilities in human history of a peaceable integration of the former Soviet Union into Europe and so on and so forth. There's a group of people who did it. It's the same group of people that tried to drug up Kanye West. It's the Jews. Okay, and we have to be able to identify what happened here, because otherwise we're going to get stuck in blind alleys like white. Did white people do this? Did white people use weaponized NATO? This is preposterous. This is preposterous, and it's going to get nowhere. No, we have to keep in mind who did it and what the result was. And so we have here now, what's the future going to be? Well, if you want to find the future, don't look into the Pope's DNA, because you're not going to find anything there. What happened during this period of time, and this was what the discussions that we were having at the Vatican at that point, was that the cardinals were disappointed. John Paul II was disappointed. Ratzinger had a moment. He had a huge tailwind from John Paul II, and he became the first American Pope. That Time magazine said it. I didn't say that. Time magazine said it. Because he accepted the Holocaust narrative and social engineering, in particular the social engineering of Germany. So he's accepting the very things that Kanye, in his dumb way, is objecting to. And it turns out that it wasn't working. At that point, under Ratzinger, the NATO is creeping ever eastward, and war is looming just over the horizon. So the cardinals say, we're going to turn to South America. And Bergoglio got elected Pope. And at the beginning of that papacy, we had access to the mind of the church. My whatever, I had just written Barren Metal. The stuff I wrote on usury was incorporated into Laudate Si. And I thought, this is a moment, because we're now going to expand beyond this bankrupt American empire. We're going to have a truly global church. We're going to incorporate a critique of capitalism, which has sort of fallen by the wayside. And it didn't happen. Didn't happen because of one thing. The Jesuits showed up and they hijacked the papacy. And I'm not just saying the Jesuit. I'm saying the New York Jesuits, the editorial advisory board of America Magazine, that crowd, James Martin, hijacked the papacy and used it to proselytize for homosexuality. Thomas Rees, the guy who came up with the banning the Latin Mass, he's another Jesuit, was his idea. He had already published it in an article. And the Pope, because he's a Jesuit, went along with this and completely muddied the waters, unfortunately. He was not a man of principle or ideas. He was a man who thought that that was un-Catholic to think philosophically. And so the moment passed, and he did not resolve the issue. I think that the same cardinals, these are cardinals who 80% of them were elected by Pope Francis. I think they understood, they're still intent on that mission. And the man who epitomizes that mission is Prevost, is Pope Leo XIV. He's an American. You listen to him speak. His Italian's impeccable. Obviously, his Spanish is impeccable. They were the only two languages he spoke during his acceptance speech. The next day, he spoke English to the Mass in the Sistine Chapel for the Cardinals, and that was obviously impeccable English. This is a man who has the language skills that are needed at this moment in time. Because now it looks as if there may be a possibility to integrate the Americas. This is a guy who grew up in the North America with all its Puritan satanic heritage, but lived in Peru with all of its Catholic heritage there, and now has chosen the name of Leo XIV. It's the only concrete thing we have to go on. The name he chose, because it's obvious that he considers himself the successor of Leo XIII. What is he famous for? He was one of the great thinkers, one of the greatest thinkers of the 19th century. He began life as the assistant to Pius IX, who was fighting the secularists, the inheritors of the French Revolution, the Risorgimento. You know all their names if you go on the subway system in Rome. These were the Freemasons that basically took over the Papal States and forced him into exile. And then at the revolution, right around the time of the revolution of 1848. So what did he do? He wrote encyclicals against Freemasonry, against the exploitation of the worker, and which was Rerum Novarum. He founded the church's social teaching, and he wrote an encyclical against Americanism, Testem Benevolentiae. This is the message that the Pope is sending us. I'm going to be the next Leo the 13th. And you put those three things together and you have some sense of where he's going. No one else seems to have that. It's like, don't analyze his DNA. That's not going to tell you anything. But if you analyze the name he chose, as I said in my tweet, Nomen Est Omen. If you analyze the name he chose, you have some type of direction of what he sees ahead of him. He also wrote an encyclical, Aeterni Patris, which established Thomism as the official philosophy of the Catholic Church. Read Logos Rising, especially the chapters on Leo the 13th and on Notre Dame University, and you'll see what happened there. The other thing was that he was one of the founding fathers of Civiltà Cattolica, the magazine, the official magazine of the Vatican, which dealt with current issues in a way that encyclicals could not. And one of the issues he dealt with, Civiltà Cattolica dealt with in 1890, was the Jewish question. Put that together, and I think you have some type of a realistic understanding based in reality, categories of reality on what we have to look forward to in the future. That's my rant. Let's see what you have to say.
All right. Hello, everybody. Hello once again. This is Mike Pajakas, Dr. Jones' assistant. Welcome to the call-in segment of the show. I want to apologize to Telegram. I brought that up a little bit late. I was jamming too hard to our intro song that I kind of forgot to hit the button. So, but you guys in Telegram are back. So, call-in segment. Welcome. Call-ins are made via our Telegram. Link's going to be in description. Wherever you may be, some quick rules. Try to keep questions on subject. Be respectful of everyone's time and do not forget, whatever you do, to unmute yourself. I allow you to speak on my end, and then you have to press unmute on your end, then you can talk. All right. Let's pull up Telegram over here, and let's start with HJRR. Go ahead. Are you there?
Yes, Dr. Jones, can you hear me?
I can.
Hey, so I real quick, I just want to tell you, we're Catholic. My son is, gone through all the confirmation and everything. And he, about a year ago, 2 years ago, he became a Protestant. And my son was talking to him. He's 15. The oldest son is 19, who became a Protestant, joined this Protestant cult. And anyways, my 15-year-old called that 20-year-old and said, "Are you getting ready to celebrate Easter?" And he said, we're celebrating Passover. I thought, these are Judaizers, as you would describe, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Is there any suggestions on how to bring him back? Like I said, he's had baptism, communion, confirmation, and then about 2 years later, he decided to investigate these other churches, and I think they just love-bombed him, and he joined this Protestant group.
Yeah. No, they have certain techniques that are effective in people who are vulnerable, emotional. There's kind of, you've said it, love bombing, this emotional sense of acceptance and so on and so forth. No thinking behind it, just emotional response. And I think that that's the way you should talk to them. The other thing is that basically the Protestant options are either homosexuality or Zionism right now. And that's why this thing is going out of business. One group will go out because they're homosexuals. The other will join up with the Jews and become de facto Jews. So, you know, what can I say? Deal with him as don't cut him off from conversation. That would be the worst thing you could do. But engage him in the conversations about what's going on in that church. And eventually, I think he'll come around. They'll see the light.
Yeah, I think so. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you for that question. Next, we're going to go to MV. Go ahead, MV.
Hey, Dr. Jones, correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard that S.J. Martin actually likes this candidate, and that in and of itself makes me a little nervous. Am I off base?
No, you're not at all. This is a man who was chosen by Bergoglio. I think he's a man who... Now, we all know what Bergoglio was, the St. Gallen group, the Synodal Vague, and all this other type of stuff. If that's the case, if he's totally included, if he's totally absorbed into that thought pattern, I don't think he would have chosen Leo the 13th. I'm basing my critique, my understanding of him, not on the superficial connection with the other bishops that were appointed by Francis, but on the Leo the 13th angle. And secondly, an assumption that this kind of Latin American understanding of the church did not find a good representative in Bergoglio, because Bergoglio turned it over to the Jesuits in, like James Martin. That's got nothing to do with Latin America, and it's got, and this Pope has already said he doesn't agree with the whole homosexual agenda. So it was hijacked. It was hijacked by the Jesuits, and now I think that the big term plan is still what they have in mind, and that's why they chose somebody to give it another try. Try it this time again, okay, but with the mind of Leo the 13th rather than the mind of James Martin.
Okay, interesting take. On another note, I couldn't help noticing something this week. There was a cryptocurrency scammer who faced federal court, and in it, it was Celsius was the name of the project, and he told a Manhattan federal judge that a sentencing memorandum, which prosecutors asked for a 20-year prison sentence, was a, quote, venom-laced attempt to paint him as a, quote, fiend and ignore his prior law-abiding business ventures and, ready for this, status as a Soviet Jewish refugee. Well, they didn't listen. They gave him 12 years, but I thought it was funny that he brought out the card and played it.
Wait a minute. Why didn't he say he had relatives who died in the Holocaust? What's going on?
No wonder
they gave him 12 years. He should have said he had relatives who died in the Holocaust.
Thank you, Dr. Jones.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, MV. Always calls in, very much a regular. Love hearing from him. Next, let's go to Jack. Go ahead, Jack. You gotta hit that little unmute button yourself on your end as well, Jack. Nope. Little button in the center. Okay, maybe we'll swing around to you. We go quick here. Gabe Bones, go ahead, Mr. Bones.
Good afternoon, Dr. Jones. Thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome.
And relevant to your comments about the racial issue and the mixed race issue, it's interesting to look at the Episcopal coat of arms of our new Pope, and I'm not sure if he's going to adopt the same motto as Pope, but he takes for his motto the Latin, in illo uno unum, which is from a commentary by St. Augustine on Psalm 128, where Augustine says, when I speak of Christians in the plural, I understand one in the one Christ. You are therefore many and ye are one. We are many and we are one. How are we many and yet one? Because we cling unto him whose members we are, and since our head is in heaven, that his members may follow. Let us therefore hear this psalm as considering it to be spoken of Christ, and all of us who cling to the body of Christ and have been made members of Christ walk in the ways of the Lord, and let us fear the Lord with a chaste fear, with a fear that abideth forever. So I thought it was a nice...
It's a brilliant, summary of the Catholic faith. In many ones, the United States tried to imitate this with e pluribus unum, from many one, but it's also the description of beauty. It's the principle of the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church is the only group that has been successful in implementing this to this day. So it was a beautiful recapitulation of that idea.
So I thought it was hopeful that he has that on the Episcopal coat of arms, and some people have taken to imagining the transformation his coat of arms might take. And instead of the cardinalate Galero hat on top, it's got the triple tiara on top. And this hasn't been officially released, but a lot of people seem to be hoping that we'll see a return of the coronation of the Pope as the King of Kings with the triple tiara.
I think he's distinctly more traditional in that regard than Francis would. Francis was a guy who liked to break with tradition and would, you know, pay his own hotel bill as long as there was plenty of cameras taking pictures of him doing that type of thing. So I don't want to make invidious comparisons here, but I think we're onto something here when you do something. I think there's a depth here of understanding the Catholic tradition, the intellectual tradition that's been missing for the past couple of years.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that question, Mr. Bones. Let's keep going. Veritasity. Go ahead, Veritasity.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Thanks, Mike and Big Mike. Hey, here's another aspect. Now, I don't know if you recognize this, but I don't want to be harsh with Cardinal Burke, but it seems to me the leaders, these people who are self-appointed, Catholic Orthodoxy people on the internet, on YouTube, okay, that they all seem to be former Protestants. Taylor Marshall, the Bishop Strickland, okay, and even, God bless him, because I don't think he's the same category, Cardinal Burke. What do you think? Is it something about, not giving up their temptation to be, revolt, even though in some ways they become traditional Catholics? What do you think about that idea? But some of these leaders of these, like, how can you judge this man when he has barely been pope for 10 minutes? Oh, he's anti-Trump or whatever.
Right.
What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there was a kind of, conservatism. It was an American ideology. It came into being during the anti-communist crusade, and American Catholics identified with it, and then it became obsolete. And then they tried to carry this obsolete category into the future, and it doesn't work. The train left. I think what I'm talking about specifically now is that the cardinals, the Vatican, gave up on waiting for American conservatives, Catholic conservatives, to get with the universal plan. They were stooges of the American Empire. And I'm talking about two people in particular. I'm talking about Michael Novak and his protege, George Weigel, who never gets tired of thumping his chest and demanding that more people die in places like the Ukraine. These are shills for the warmongers, for the military-industrial complex. And I think that they at a certain point, the scales fell from Pope John Paul II's eyes and also from the eyes of the cardinals and the bishops. It came, I think, when Michael Novak used to brag about his candlelight dinners with Pope John Paul II, in which he persuaded him to give capitalism a chance. That came out centesimus annus, where the Pope said basically, if by capitalism you mean a conditional type of acceptance, that was not fulfilled. And the end came when Michael Novak showed up and tried to persuade the Pope to endorse the Iraqi war, and he didn't even get in the door. Sorry, Mike, no more candlelight dinners with the Pope. You're a shill for the CIA. Forget it. And I think this disillusionment spread through the church, and they were looking for someone that would take it up. I think you add to that, I think that Pope Francis had a visceral dislike of American Catholic conservatives, epitomized by Burke, and he just wouldn't talk to him. He disliked him intensely, and he didn't understand him. His buddy Tuco Fernandez didn't understand. They didn't understand what was going on in America, and they basically did things that they shouldn't have done. And I'm talking specifically about the way they treated Vigano. Vigano, God bless him, is completely off the rails. He went completely off the rails. But he did it. I mean, he's got his own fault. He's in schism. He left the church. He's in rebellion. He hates the Rome and so on and so forth. But what did they do to him? You know, Vigano arranged a meeting between Kim Davis, a lady in Kentucky who was refusing to give out marriage licenses to homosexuals. He arranged a meeting between her and Pope Francis. Everything went well. Pope Francis gave her rosaries. And then when he gets back, that crowd, Supich, I think Rossica, the Canadian, turned the Pope against him, and the Pope threw Vigano under the bus. He shouldn't have done that, and Vigano never got over it. Okay, these are the type of errors that basically poisoned that papacy. And I think we're going to have to step back. I think that the church is still committed to some type of modus vivendi. They still have this, I think, looking to the Catholics in Latin America as a big force for good in the world, and they're going to try it again, but this time with a guy who's more sophisticated, more deeply involved in both America, North America, and South America. I don't think there's anybody who's more involved in both of those countries than this guy, and maybe the hope is that they will be able to bring up some type of reconciliation of the American Catholic Church or the American Empire with the rest of the world. That wouldn't have been my plan. I was hoping that Cardinal Pizzaballo would become Pope so that he would confront the Jewish question, the Israeli genocide directly, but that I'm not a cardinal. I didn't vote, and they didn't vote for that either.
Yeah, I was pulling for him too, but now, I'll just say one other thing. There's an interesting paradox here about Bergoglio and the whole Argentina thing. Now, remember, so he was like, because he was from Argentina, it was supposed to be, oh, he's going to be a Hispanic Pope. I think culturally, Bergoglio was actually more Italian, which many people from Argentina are, even though he was technically born and raised in Argentina, which he never went back to after he became Pope. And now this Pope, God bless him, I wish him only the best. Technically, he's American, but I think culturally, he really is Peruvian.
I think so, too. I think you're right. I think he felt more at home in Peru than he did. And the only other option during the rest of his life was pretty much being administrator for international orders like the Augustinians and being in Rome and being part of the Curia as the head of the Congregation for Bishops. So I think he doesn't have the limitations of an American like Cardinal Burke, I would say. He doesn't have that type of limitation. And I'm calling conservatism an ideological limitation. It's an obsolete ideology. There's no point in imposing on it, on the church. The day of the anti-communist crusade is over. We're into a new era. And I think there's no point in trying to drag obsolete categories into this new era.
All right. Thank you, Veritasi. We're going to keep going here. Try to get one or two more questions in, and then you guys will go to the chat.
We can go a little longer this time because, if you know, it's an important moment.
That's true. All right. Well, then, yeah, we'll continue three or four here, and then we'll get to the chats. But regardless, type your questions in because we're going to get to them. Jack, we're going to try you again. I unmuted you. Are you there, Jack?
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can.
Hi, Dr. Jones. So I was intrigued by the example that you gave last week on the of your bike ride through the black neighborhood in Philadelphia when you were younger, and also that you brought up the earlier today.
Sorry, Jack, you're breaking up. Repeat.
Did we lose you, Jack? You're breaking up a bit. Are you there?
Okay. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. So I was riding my bike through North Philadelphia. That's the last thing we heard from you. And you were intrigued by it.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And then I was also, you know, glad you brought up Shiloh Hendricks earlier in the show today. And I think you're correct that the Shiloh situation represents sort of the collapse of the racial fears and racial pieties of the Third Republic. And you've mentioned the racial fears, racial pieties before as sort of a prohibiting factor in Catholics resettling urban ethnic neighborhoods. So right. I'm curious if you think that this, now that the Third Republic is collapsing, the Fourth is emerging, if you think there's another opportunity here for Catholics to resettle urban ethnic neighborhoods now that the fear of the Negro is no longer a viable category.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. You're referring to Cincinnati. I told those people to move into over the Rhine. Nobody listened to me because of Negrophobia. That's what it was. It was that simple. They had all these fears. I think that what you're seeing on the part of oligarchic instruments like X, I think it's an oligarchic instrument, is the attempt to restart, resurrect racial hatred. I think it's clear. And they're trying to foment the white boys this time around instead of the black boys, you know. But either way, it takes two to tangle. And if you think that you're, now is the great chance and we're going to assert white identity and we're not going to, I'm going to give $50 to the Shiloh and show them. You're just reinforcing the narrative that enslaves us, which is black versus white. I don't care whether you take the white side or the black side. It's divi de et impera, divide and conquer. That's what the Roman Empire did. That's what the American Empire is doing. That's what they did in Virginia when they created the term white and black to begin with. I'm saying this is the moment for the Catholic alternative, which does not see race as a divisive issue. And the proof of that is the current Pope, whose mother is a Creole. This is not a Catholic category. This is the moment to get with the Catholic thing and move beyond all of this division into a country that has a plan for cooperating peacefully with each other. That is the whole point of the Catholic Church, instead of stoking division, which is the Jews are masters of doing.
I agree. One follow-up. I wanted to ask you if you're aware of any places in the United States currently where this urban resettlement effort is taking place.
Well, I mean, people are trying to do it in South Bend. I mean, people, I don't know. The Cincinnati thing, I think, is dead. I mean, the next generation has moved on. Other than that, I don't know. I'm kind of out of that business right now, but I'm sure it's happening one way or the other, because what we're talking about is the revitalization of the parish, and the parish is there. It just needs people to fill it up and to take back the areas that were from which they were driven.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, and we're going to keep going, and we'll hit the chat when Dr. sees fit. So let's go with Amy Smith. You're next on EMG Live.
Hi, Dr. Jones.
Hi, Amy.
I just wanted to see if you had a thought or take on the woke right, the agenda of people like Jordan Peterson and James Lindsay to try to paint pro-Palestine advocacy with being woke, and trying to paint supporting Israel and, you know, the idea of the special victim status of Jews and the control from the top down by the government of what can be and cannot be said on campuses, like the most egregious abridgment of free speech with force of law, and try to say that's somehow not woke and you know, that sleight of hand.
It's total contradiction. Total contradiction, like epitomized by the Vance speech, where he says you can't do this. Well, the Jews are doing exactly the same thing in America. I don't think it's going to stand. I forget the lady's name, but some Palestinian lady was just released from prison. Her sentence was annulled because it's a clear, these speech codes on campuses where you're forbidden to criticize Israel, it's clear violation of the First Amendment. It's not going to stand here. And Trump, once it gets overturned, Trump will lose interest anyway and he'll move on. The other thing I've been hearing is that Trump is at war with Netanyahu, that they're not talking to each other. That's good. I'm saying that we have this chance to work things out. I don't think it's going to get really worked out until we have a coherent picture of what's going on. And to do that, we have to transcend the racial issue and get to the group of people that's always been fomenting racial conflict in this country. And I'm talking about the Jews. Ever since the creation of the ADL, the creation of the NAACP, after around the time of Leo Frank, this has always been the case. We have to identify the enemy properly. And if we don't do that, we're going to get sucked back into the same old vortex of black versus white.
So just, I also think it's really important that we as Catholics be making sure that people, other Catholics and people in the community, are not learning about Catholics from the Jewish point of view. It's very, even including within like the Catholic Register, whatever that paper is. I heard someone on the radio recently saying the terrible anti-Semitism of the church until Vatican II, that's just complete slander. And, you know, they keep trying to say the Pope during the, you know, Pope Pius XII was a Nazi supporter, all this slander. And if we don't like encourage people to know that correct history, we can't correct that. And I think everyone should read all your books, but for the people who don't know or are doing other things, we who do read the books need to get this information to other people so that we can be, you know, not letting them get away with slandering our saints and
That's right.
slandering our church.
That's right. We should not internalize the commands of our oppressors. Now, concretely, many people who have read the Holocaust narrative and heard me talk about Christus and Dachau have children who are in high school, and one of the required texts is Elie Wiesel's Night, which is the Jews hijacked the Holocaust narrative, turned Auschwitz into the paradigmatic concentration camp, obliterated any memory of Dachau and the Catholics who were there. And this is being basically forced on young Catholic students in high school by making them read Elie Wiesel's Night. And so a lot of these people have taken my advice and they go to the teacher first and say, this is a Catholic school. It would be much more appropriate if you read Christus in Dachau rather than Elie Wiesel's Night. This is propaganda for atheism. You don't want to be telling Catholic, impressionable Catholic high school students that God died at Auschwitz, which is the moral of Elie Wiesel's fake memoir. So there's a concrete step that I think all Catholic parents, especially those with students in high school, should take. Tell the teacher to go read Christus in Dachau. That's a better book for understanding the Holocaust than Elie Wiesel's Night.
Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Amy. We still keep going here, Doc?
Yeah, let's keep going. We'll
keep going. There's
as long
a lot
as
of questions.
You have questions.
Well, there's a lot of questions in the chat, so I mean, it's up to you.
All right,
I mean,
just let's do one more, and then we'll go to the chat.
All right. I think I saw Midwest hanging out here for a while, so let's go to him. Midwest, are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. Dr. Jones, I just got back from watching the movie Sinners. Have you heard of it?
I have.
Okay. It is something I think I would love to hear you analyze. One thing in particular about the film, I'm not going to spoil it or whatever, is I'm wondering if we should even just continue with the categories of black and white, because one thing the film is about is it's about black music. And I do love black music. You know, I love black jazz, black hip hop, black hardcore. But if you talk to a lot of those artists, what they'll say is, unless you're talking to Ice Cube, he'll say the Jew. But a lot of those artists will say that the white man is stealing their music from them, you know, and appropriating their culture. But I'm wondering if that's just another method of division among the people that love to create together, or
look, anytime a black person says white in this context, I'm talking about the music industry, the entertainment industry. He's really means Jew, but he's afraid to say it. They don't want to ruin their career, so they start. This is the whole point of fomenting hatred against white people. The classic example was the Harlem riot of, I believe, 1939, okay? Fiorello LaGuardia, who was a Jew in spite of his Italian name, immediately portrayed as a black-white conflict. That was not a black-white conflict. That was a black-Jewish conflict. And they immediately tried to erase the Jew by turning him into a white guy. This has got to stop. We can't allow this to happen anymore. And I'm saying this is the fundamental purpose of the black-white narrative, because as soon as you say white, the Jew becomes invisible. This is Jared Taylor's grift. He's been turning Jews into white boys for decades now. As soon as the Jew becomes white, he becomes invisible. And we can't allow this to happen, because if we do, we cannot identify the enemy. And this goes for black people as well. Don't blame it on whitey when it's the Jew who's doing it, okay? To all my black friends out there. Not that they do that, but, you know, you get the message.
Right. Just real quick, do you think there's going to be a point in history, I'm not seeing it, but where we won't see along racial lines, where we'll ascend to a more spiritual view? Or will that only be possible once we're all in the grace of God in heaven?
I think as soon as we become Catholic, as soon as the United States becomes a Catholic country, de facto, according to obviously all of the historical circumstances that inhibit that type of thing, that will be the end of the race issue. That's why what we're talking about here, the preserving the race issue means attacking the Catholic Church or misrepresenting the Catholic Church as if it's somehow compatible with racial ideology, which is what Dave Riley is doing. Read the book. I've already talked about this on YouTube. Read the article, Guns and Rosaries, The Rise of White Catholicism. This is an attempt here to rob Catholics of their identity by telling them that they're white, or that white ideology, racial ideology, is compatible with Catholicism. It is not. It is not. Okay? And the point here is, as soon as the Catholic consciousness pervades the United States of America, this whole racial conflict thing will disappear, because it doesn't happen in Catholic countries.
Okay. Thank you so much. God bless you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Midwest. Okay. Now to jump to the chats. Here we go. All right. First is going to be on Rumble. Christians Praying asks, will this Pope reform the clergy and or bishops? He has the credentials.
He's already reformed the bishops. He got rid of Bishop Strickland. That was an attempt to reform the bishops. I've written about that extensively in an article in Culture Wars magazine, and you can read it there. But basically, he would not allow the bishop to get involved in this real estate project and bringing Michael Voris in as the Catholic media apostolate. The bishop stepped in and stopped it. So he's already done it, and I think he'll be capable of doing it in the future. One of the things that needs to be redone, in my humble opinion, is take that document that Tuco Fernandez did and throw it in the trash can and start all over again, because it just simply enabled the money laundering operation to continue in Medjugorje.
Let's see. Twitter, we have a question from Gabriel Garza. What does Mr. Jones think about the ethnic categories of Mexico?
Mexico is a country. It is has a national identity. But the Mexicans are the cosmic race. It's a country that's made based on race mixing. The cosmic race is the mixture of the native Indian population with the Hispanic population, creating the mestizo, the mixed race. And this is the work of the Catholic Church under the auspices of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who appeared as a mestiza. So, yes, we're talking about a very definite ethnic identity here. That is biracial, by the way. That's the point I'm trying to make.
All right. Next question from also retired on Rumble. Will Provost follow Leo XIII and take a position against religious freedom from Vatican II, a la John Courtney Murray?
Who?
Provost, was that the Pope's, current Pope's? What was his?
Who?
P-R-E-V-O-S-T. Follow Pope Leo XIII.
Prevost. That's Pope Leo the 14th.
Follow
who?
Pope Leo the 13th.
Yes, he's going to follow him. That's what he said. That's why he chose the name. Follow him in what direction? By doing what?
Against religious freedom from Vatican II.
Well, as I said when I met with the people in the Vatican, I said religious freedom has got to be, this issue has to be clarified. Because it's been heavily influenced by John Courtney Murray and the CIA, who basically wrote, John Courtney Murray wrote the notes for that Dignitatis Humanae, and they distorted it. The church did not accept the separation of church and state. And anybody who says they did is distorting Dignitatis Humanae, largely at the behest of John Courtney Murray.
Okay, where was it? Someone had a good question here. From W. Priest on Rumble. Dr. Jones, maybe I missed it, but do you think Pope Leo XIV will address the Jewish question?
I said Pope Leo XIII created Civiltà Cattolica, and they addressed the Jewish question. On the other hand, I think the person who was primed to deal with it directly was Cardinal Pizzaballa. So you could be, there could be a sense in which what's the message here? Maybe we're not going to address the Jewish question in the way that Pizzaballa would have. That would have sent a message to the entire world that the church is standing by the Palestinians. Okay, this does not send that same message. So that's a good question, and it's hard to judge because you got two conflicting signals here. The Civiltà Cattolica series on the one hand, but then the non-choice of Pizzaballa on the other.
Next question we got on Cozy from WZ10997. Nietzsche said, what is falling, one should also push. Will Leo XIV do that with regard to the American empire?
I don't think it needs any pushing. I think that what they're trying to do is get some guy who is absolutely an American, a North American, a gringo, whatever you want to call him, and also has exactly a firmly planted a foot in South America so that we can bring about some type of Hegelian synthesis here. A kind of peaceful Hegelian synthesis rather than a violent break, rather than any type of violence. So let's do whatever we can to assure a peaceful landing for the American empire. I think that's the mission of the church in the world today. And maybe a direct confrontation over Gaza, much as I would have preferred it, maybe they decided according to their opinion, that would be counterproductive. This is all pure speculation on my part.
Next question from SS Tiger SS on Cozy. Do you think Pope Leo XIV can restore Bishop Strickland and Father Pavone in a magnanimous, merciful gesture to unite?
No. I mean, could, yes. He can do whatever he wants, but will he? No, the answer is no.
Okay. What if Strickland turns around himself, and do you even see it possibly.
Well, happen. I mean, let's be like a more realistic scenario would say if Vigano woke up and realized he had committed a grave sin and begged for forgiveness and went to Rome for the trial and submitted to Rome's authority. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but that seems, of course, they would accept him. We are now in a situation in Medjugorje where Jozo Zovko wants to come back to Medjugorje, and the bishop, Bishop Perich, or the new bishop, is willing to let him back, but under certain conditions. So, I mean, the church has always believes in forgiveness, but in situations like this, I don't see these people asking for forgiveness. I don't see it happening. The Bishop Williamson stand barefoot in the snow at Canossa? No. No, Bishop Williamson was waiting for Rome to come to him and ask for admission to his church. This is tragic, but this is often the way these situations end.
Okay. Simon on Telegram asks, Dr. Jones, do you see any redeeming qualities to someone famous as Kanye West breaking the Jew taboo and making a song called Nigga Heil Hitler?
I think it's a stupid move. I mean, it plays right into the hands of the ADL. They love it because they can raise money now saying Kanye West is an anti-Semite, he's spreading anti-Semitism. I'm sure the next IPAC convention, they will have the video that we just played. They'll play it at the IPAC convention saying they're ready to fire up the gas chambers, blah, blah, blah. You know, so no, I think it was counterproductive. I think that he could have done, especially in terms of the realm of art, he could have done something that was more effective. But, you know, God moves in history. I suppose is it good that the taboos are broken? I think it's better to elucidate them and explain their fallacious nature, their lack of foundation in reality, than to simply go over to the other side and lionize a guy like Hitler. I think that's stupid.
There you are. Good question here. Rumble Dan T19 asks, Dr. Jones, what exactly is the heresy of Americanism?
That's a good question. I cover this in my American Identity book in detail. Basically, there was a biography of Father Hecker, who founded the Paulist in French, and the French hierarchy did not like it. They thought they were spreading revolutionary ideas. They were very sensitive to revolution at this point, and with good reason. They've had a revolution basically every 10 years in France after the French Revolution. Revolution of 1830, 1848, 1870. And so they were we don't want people spreading revolutionary ideas. That's not really what Hecker was about. And then you extrapolate from Hecker then to John Ireland. John Ireland says, well, of course I accept everything that the Pope says, but nobody believes in that over here. Well, if you read the correspondence between John Ireland and Monsignor O'Connell, you'd realize that there was room for fear of what we would call Americanism, but it dealt it a glancing blow, which is something you do not want to do. Either you want to kill it or you want to leave it alone, but don't deal it a glancing blow. And that meant basically that it went underground at places like Notre Dame and resurrected in the 40s and 50s. So that was the problem with Testem Benevolentiae. Is there such a thing as an Americanism? Yes, of course there is. Were the Irish bishops like Ireland Americanist? Yes, of course they were, but the encyclical didn't deal with it effectively.
Next on Rumble, we have PSUMJ. Question for Dr. Jones. Did Ezra remake Judaism so that it could be practiced anywhere?
Ezra, the prophet? Are you?
I'm as easy, RA, that's always got.
No. Okay. No. I mean, there were, I'm sure there were hints in the Old Testament there would be a new Zion where it Jesus Christ said it to the Samaritan woman, the time will come when you won't have to be a Jew, but salvation comes from the Jews, but there's time will come, and that's precisely the Catholic Church of that fulfillment. But it could not be under the auspices of anyone in the Old Testament, because they were bound, the Mosaic covenant bound them to a kind of ethnic pact, a covenant that was based on, you know, animal sacrifice in the temple, which excluded other people.
All right, next we have Cozy. Now, this person isn't specific, but I think, you know, I know what he's talking about. User on Cozy. Do you think Leo XIV will address any of the three crucial issues of the church? If so, which one and why? I think he's talking about Judaism, probably homosexuality, and usury. I mean, you already addressed Judaism. What about homosexuality?
Look, if he's already, usury? If he said Leo XIII, the last two words in Rerum Novarum, the beginning of social teaching, are rapacious usury. That's what I said to the official at the Vatican when I talked to him at the beginning of the papacy of Francis. We have to address this issue. It's an absolutely crucial issue. Whether he addresses the Jewish question, I have nothing to go on here. I have nothing to go on other than what I said, which is that basically Civiltà Cattolica addressed the Jewish question. Civiltà Cattolica was Leo XIII's magazine. So that's all I have to go on at this point. Don't have enough information.
All right. And how long do you want to keep going? Just keep going?
Let's have two more.
All right. Let's see. There's one from Dirtis on Rumble. Dr. J, aren't the self-imposed identities of white and black a direct problem resulting from the assimilation of ethnicities in America? How can this problem be solved?
No, I know. I see them as completely different. The assimilation of ethnicities was disrupted by the black and white narrative. The classic example I've talked about is the black takeover of ethnic neighborhoods in cities like Chicago, Detroit, and Philadelphia, and every other big city in the North. So the black and white narrative comes from the, as I said, from the slave rebellion in Virginia. It led to the Civil War. By the end of the 19th century, with the arrival of the Jews took it over and tried to foment racial conflict with groups like the NAACP. I don't think they're two completely different things. They did bump into each other. As I mentioned before, when Martin Luther King showed up in Chicago and wanted to invade Marquette Park, the people came out in force. They were Lithuanians. So here you had the two narratives coming together, the ethnic narrative coming together with the racial narrative, and the racial narrative basically defeated the ethnic narrative by saying, oh, they're white people, by turning them into white people. That's exactly what you do not want to do. Exactly. So some lady wrote to me and said, well, if they're attacking us as a group, we have to respond as a group. No, that's exactly what you don't want to do. You do not want to internalize the commands of your oppressors by saying that you're white, because you're not white, because in a sense, no one is white other outside of the government imposing this category of the mind on you to oppress you. Just every bit as much as the category of black was opposed to people, imposed on people in the 19th century to oppress them. It's a narrative of oppression. And you want to break free of that into the real narrative, which is ethnic, which is a category of reality.
All right, next, last question of the night. Danville 33 on Rumble asks, will the new Pope focus on this hideous genocide in Gaza?
Good question. I think that what we're seeing here is that the cardinals decided they don't want someone to address directly the genocide in Gaza, because if they had, they would have chosen Cardinal Pete Zabala, who is the Patriarch of Jerusalem. He was the ideal man. He was a front runner, as far as I could tell, unless I'm delusional, unless they're just telling me what I want to hear. And I think the fact that they did not choose him was a deliberate choice on their part not to confront this issue directly. Now, whether this is going to go down as a day of infamy in the name, in the history of the Catholic Church, that's another matter, because, someone will come up and say the church was silent. They did this with Pius XII. Why didn't he say something about the gas chambers, blah, blah, blah? That's a different but similar situation. There may be a time when, look, this is the fundamental issue facing mankind right now. Does a small group of people have the right to commit genocide because they have Jewish privilege? This is a fundamental challenge to civilization. And I think the church should have confronted it directly, but hey, I'm not a cardinal and I'm not the Pope, certainly not the Pope.
All right. Well, there you guys have it. Once again, this is EMJ Live. We are here every Friday at 5 Eastern Standard Time. Make sure to subscribe to Dr. Jones Magazine, Culture Wars Magazine at culturewars.com. And of course, all the books that you heard about tonight and forever of Dr. Jones can only be found at fidelitypress.org. Like the videos, subscribe to Telegram, all that. And realchristianityfirst.com. If you're in the main area or if you want to fly out to the main area, June Symposium. Our friends are hosting Dr. Jones out there. It's going to be great. realchristianityfirst.com. If you want to hear Dr. Jones speak live in person, go to that website. Sign up. Final words, Dr. Jones.
Thank you. Thank you for all of your support. Let's pray for the Pope and for a successful pontificate that where he can deal with the problems facing the church and the world. Because this is a crucial turning point, a crucial turning point. The old world is collapsing every bit as much as the old Roman Empire collapsed, and it had to be filled with the spirit of the church to continue. That's exactly what's happening right now with the American Empire. So pray that the Pope can lead in this direction.
Thanks, guys. Amen. God bless. We'll see you next week.